yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, central banks are in the news again. You must be getting tired of hearing about it, but, you know, right now there's nothing that influences the standard of living more, except maybe Congress shifting taxes from the rich to the rest of us. Not much else happening. Healthcare bill, of course. They keep reissuing it, and it's really the same thing. The Senate came out with another version of the health bill. And, yeah, what they said was they're going to leave the investment tax on the rich. There's a 3.8% tax on the rich. I mean, the very rich, 1% above. That was part of the original ACA bill to help finance it. So this version of the Senate bill that came out said, oh, okay, before we were going to cut that tax and all the other taxes on the rich, $600 billion worth, big tax cut. That's what that bill is all about. Oh, but, you know, created a firestorm. How can you cut $800 billion in Medicaid for the poor and disabled and single moms and so forth and give the rich a $600 billion tax cut? How can you do that? Well, it's hard even for some of the Republicans to swallow. So they revised it, and it came back here just a day or so ago. I think it was yesterday. And, okay, we'll leave the 3.8% investment tax on the rich. Oh, what a tactical legerdemain manipulation that is. Because, okay, they leave the 3.8% investment tax in place. But, you know, there's a big corporate tax bill, investor tax bill, coming right on the heels of this. And they'll just offset it or quietly delete it, the tax, in the tax bill coming. It's just a gimmick, a maneuver by McConnell leaving it in. They'll take it out again when the tax bill, tax cut, corporate investor tax cut bill, we should call it, comes in a couple more months. This is the kind of games these people play. I don't know. And another interesting feature of this bill, okay, we're going to let people get a tax deduction for buying these phantom health care plans. Why do I call them phantom? Because they really don't provide you any coverage at all. These phantom bills will have so much exemptions and exceptions and such high deductibles that it really won't be much of a health care bill or insurance coverage at all. That's what's new in these two Senate in this new Senate bill here, you know. A phony tactical maneuver on leaving some tax cuts in, I mean taxes in rather than cuts, for the rich, and phantom health plans for the rest. Well, you know, went over like a lead balloon, and we'll see if they go back to the drawing board again. I think they're going to do something reckless and pass something that overwhelmingly the American people are going to reject. We'll see if they're that stupid. Some of them are, of course. Okay, that was an interesting development. Another interesting development before we get on to our central bank meeting here, the Fed and other central banks. Another interesting development was financial deregulation. You know, this Dodd-Frank bill that was passed in 2010, kind of a toothless tiger. But nonetheless, tiger is better than a pussycat. Well, that's being unraveled behind the scenes. It's losing a lot of the attention that this health care bill and the tax cuts and the tweets by his majesty there, Trump. Remember Trump? Financial deregulations being picked apart. And who's coming up with the new regulations? Well, Goldman Sachs. Yeah, Steve Mnuchin from Goldman Sachs. And big news, stress test and the deregulation that's coming. The banks are watching that very close, you know. And now part of the deregulation, Dodd-Frank, is that the banks can issue big payouts to their investors, the stockholders, the shareholders. Yeah, big announcement. Banks are going to redistribute $130 billion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts now. Well, no wonder bank stocks took a shot upward here this past week, driving the stock market with it. You see, that's all bank stock-driven stuff. $130 billion coming. Yeah. That's deregulation, you see. What we got is an acceleration of income redistribution going on. It was chronic and occurring here under Bush, in particular George Bush Jr. and Obama. But now it's even accelerating even faster. You see, the capitalists today, they don't make money, many of them, particularly in finance. They're given free money. That's what this central bank regime since 2009 is all about. It's all about subsidizing the financial sector. They used to talk about central bank functions, you know, like regulating the money supply, supervising the banks, and lender of last resort, which means bailouts. They used to talk about that, lender of last resorts. Okay, when the banks get in trouble, and they always do, periodically, and we have a crisis, then they have to be bailed out. Who bails them out? Congress doesn't bail them out. No, no, no. The Federal Reserve, the central bank, bails them out. That's what happened in 2008-9. The central bank bailed out the banks. The Fed, Federal Reserve, bailed out the banks to the tune of trillions of dollars. And they were bailed out by 2010. And one way you bail them out is you provide free money to them, zero interest rates. Okay, they provided free money, zero interest rates, and the Fed on top of that went out and bought securities from investors that had collapsed in values. Remember subprimes and others? They bought $4.5 trillion from investors and private banks and shadow banks and so forth. $4.5 trillion. Well, they didn't go to the government and get bonds to do that. Treasury didn't write bonds that the Federal Reserve then sold. No, no. What happened was the Fed printed the money electronically, but printed the money and gave it to the banks for free. And then the banks just loaned that out and got an interest on it. By loaning it out to non-bank companies and shadow banks and other investors around the world. And that's how they got that $4.5 trillion. Well, they didn't lend out. They bought these securities, you see. $4.5 trillion on the balance sheet. But as I said last week, it's more than $4.5 trillion. The $4.5 trillion is just the net result, what we got now, because some of these bonds that have been bought, subprimes and so forth, matured over the period since 2009 to 2017. But as they matured and got paid off, the Fed reissued the money and bought even more bonds. So really, the Fed has bought maybe about $7 trillion. I've seen some estimates. Not $4.5 of what's called quantitative easing bonds. And all the other central banks followed the same route. Bank of England, yeah, initially about $650 billion, and now they got a new one going here since Brexit last year. The European Central Bank in 2015 started doing this, $68 billion a month in bonds they're buying up, corporate bonds as well as government bonds over there, $68 billion, so maybe about $3 trillion cumulative so far. And continuing, by the way. And Japan, Bank of Japan, even more aggressive, $4 trillion and continuing. And although it's not QE per se, direct bond buying, the People's Bank of China has pumped maybe $4 to $5 trillion into its banks and its financial system as well. So, you know, put the People's Bank of China aside, just looking at the big central banks of the West here, including the Bank of Japan and so forth, there's about $15 trillion at least of direct central bank buying, electronically printing and buying assets from private investors. Now, this is really significant. It can't be underestimated, because what it represents is that this lender of last resort function, the central banks historically, lender of last resort, bail out the banks when they get in trouble, has now transformed into a permanent subsidization of the financial and banking systems. It's permanent now. Notwithstanding the fact that they're talking about raising rates, they're not going to be able to raise them very much. We'll talk about that a little bit more. We'll see over the next year. It won't go very much, because the system is still so fragile and the recovery so poor that raising rates just a little bit is going to precipitate another recession. It may be worse than the last one, and they know it. They know it. So why are they raising rates? Because they're trying desperately to get a cushion for reducing rates again when the next recession comes, which I'm predicting is 2018. That's what's happening. That's why they're raising rates desperately. Because they got rates were down to zero. What are you going to do? Now, this monetary policy, central bank policy, is what's driving the whole capitalist policy regime since 2008-09. The banks were bailed out in 2010, and we've continued for seven more years of providing them free money. Seven more years. Well, that's just subsidization. They didn't need it. But we gave it, kept giving it to them anyway. And, you know, the cover has been, the central bank, the Fed, and Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke before, we're all doing this in order to stimulate the real economy. Right? The whole argument, phony ideological argument, was that if you reduce interest rates, it'll make the cost of money so cheap that non-bank businesses will borrow it, and the borrowing will result in real investment and hiring and jobs and incomes and consumption and economy recovery. You know, that's the phony mainstream economics argument, as if cheap money, even free money, would be borrowed by businesses to expand their businesses when people aren't buying their stuff anyway. It doesn't matter how cheap you make money. If no one's there to buy your stuff, why would you add more stuff? Money demand is more important than money supply. Okay, well, I don't want to get too esoteric here in terms of economics. But if the economy was doing so well today that Yellen and others keep saying it is, why do we see inflation slowing? Yeah, this is kind of an anomaly here, isn't it? You know, the Fed has started to raise rates and prices are falling. Now, the Fed's target, official target, has been a 2% inflation rate. Inflation in goods and services, things you and I buy, right? We're not talking about inflation in financial securities like stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, so forth. That's been booming. We're talking about the Fed's target of 2% is goods and services prices. And as the Fed is raising rates, the prices are falling. Well, slowing. The rate of growth is slowing. How much? Well, the Fed really started raising rates here since last December, haven't they? You know, about a percent, quarter percent at a time, and the last one just last month. Okay, so it's at the low rate is no longer zero. It's 1.25%. Ah, but inflation has already, it is declining. They're supposed to be raising rates when they hit the target of 2%. Well, the target is going south, and they're raising rates. It's not as if they were at 2%, and now's the time to raise rates. No, the target's going the other way. Report just came out today. Consumer price index in the U.S. last month, zero, no growth. And core prices, you know, that they talk about without the fluctuation of food and energy, core prices, 0.1%. And if you look at the trend for the last 3 months, it's negative. Headline inflation is CPI inflation is negative 0.3%. It's deflation. Okay? And if you look at just the core, annualized, I'm talking about annualizing these rates, it's growing. In other words, the last 3 months, inflation's flat. And if you remove rents, which have been going through the roof, right, remove rents from that CPI, and the deflation is even more significant, negative 1.1%. So prices have been slowing, declining, deflating, and the Fed is raising rates. Go figure. Why? Because the Fed's target of 2% inflation, all this talk of inflation goals and targets is just BS. It's phony. It's for public consumption. The Fed's target is to give money to the banks and the financial sector in the hopes that maybe some of it will trickle down into real investment that creates real jobs instead of going offshore or going into financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, and so forth, and ballooning and bubbling those markets, which it has been. Yes. Phony. 2%, that's phony. Well, the proof is what's happening. Inflation's going down, and they're trying to raise rates. Because they're desperate. They know another recession's coming, and they got to create some kind of a buffer for the next one. Because if they leave it, they got no ammunition at all. That's the consequence of the capitalists putting all their eggs in the monetary policy basket in 2008-09 and continuing that for 8 years now. Monetary policy is the only game in town. Fiscal policy has been put on the sidelines, except for tax cuts, if you consider that, for the rich, if you consider that fiscal policy, which I guess you could say. But as far as fiscal policy, government spending, infrastructure, and all that, you know, that's been put on side for almost a decade now. They put monetary policy, therefore, the central banks in the driver's seat, the capitalists. Well, why did they do that? Because the bankers have taken over the government. And have for several decades now, and increasingly so. Well, who's running the U.S. domestic policy, the government economic policy? Well, it's Goldman Sachs. Steve Mnuchin, Goldman Sachs. New York Fed, Dudley, Goldman Sachs. And now they're going to put Gary Cohn into the Fed chair here when Yellen's term runs out next February. Gary Cohn's front runner there. Right? And how about the Fed deregulation? You know, that started here with unraveling Dodd-Frank and so forth. Deregulation enables the banks to pay off their shareholders. Well, who's going to be running that? Well, this guy Quarles. Where's he come from? Well, Carlyle. Big shadow bank, Carlyle Group, which the Bushes are deep into. Original founders. Yeah, so we got government by bankers. The bankers are running the government, and Goldman Sachs is in the catbird seat. Yeah, remember Goldman Sachs, the one that gave $250,000 a crack to Hillary for her speeches, you know? They play both sides of the street, you see. Both wings of the corporate party of America get well-funded by Goldman Sachs. And the reason we have this dominance of monetary policy is we have a dominance of the political side now going on since the 1990s, at least, by the bankers. That's why, crash 2008-09, no bankers get indicted. No one goes to jail. Well, you go back to 1989-90 when we had the first savings and loan bust. Remember that? Cost taxpayers $300 billion to bail out the SNLs. Well, dozens went to jail. Dozens of CEOs of SNLs went to jail. Now, 2008-09, 10 times more, bigger, more than 10 times, financial crisis and crash, none of them go. Well, political influence, that's what it is. And it's going to continue. It's getting worse, right? Now, Janet Yellen had, a press conference this past week, and she indicated that the economy is doing fine. The U.S. economy is doing fine. Well, if it was doing so fine, why is inflation declining and deflation appearing? You know, you get declining prices and deflation when there's insufficient demand for goods and services. That's a reflection that people don't have spending power to purchase things. Wages aren't really rising. And, yes, that's true, they're not really rising. I'll explain that next week. And that does not stimulate price increases. So, you know, the fact that prices are slowing and even deflating now in the U.S. is an indication of a weak economy. Oh, they point to all the jobs that have been created, 150,000, 200,000 jobs every month. And unemployment rate is so low, 4.4%. Well, that doesn't mean anything if the jobs don't pay much. People still can't spend much. They ought to look at Japan, where unemployment, I think, is less than 3%. It's been that way for well more than a decade. Virtually no unemployment there, but prices are deflating nonetheless. That's that hybrid Keynesian argument that wages cause inflation, right? The whole idea of reducing unemployment means more people have more jobs, therefore more wage income, and they spend more wage income, and wages drive prices. Well, all those assumptions are wrong. You see, that's built into what they called the Phillips curve, they used to call. There's an inverse relationship between wages and prices and unemployment, employment levels, and wages. Well, it just doesn't hold. There is no Phillips curve. Wages aren't driving prices. And jobs aren't driving wages. So much for mainstream economic theory. Needs a total rethink. Okay, so inflation, and by the way, not just consumer prices, but producer prices, 0.1%. Zero consumer prices last month, 0.1% producer prices. In other words, that's what's coming in the pipeline. No pressure there. Slowing is an indication of the economy not robust, not really recovering, at best moving sideways. Now, there's other indications that the economy is very weak as well. Don't look at unemployment rates. That doesn't tell you anything, because the U3 unemployment rate, as they call it, that 4.4%, is just worthless as an indicator. You got to look at the U6 unemployment rate, which factors in where all the jobs have been created, which is contingent labor, gig labor, part-time, temp, independent contracts, so on and so forth, low paid, no benefits, etc., labor. That's where all the job creation is occurring. And that doesn't generate much price increase, goods and services price increase. Okay, so that's one indicator. The other indicator is bank lending. You know, if the economy was robust, banks would be loaning out commercial and industrial loans, which is small, medium businesses, most of the country. They'd be loaning out even more as the economy was recovering. And those businesses would be borrowing more because they want to expand because the economy is recovering. Right? And households would be borrowing more as well because their incomes would be rising. Well, what's the data on household and commercial and industrial loans? Over the past year, right, commercial and industrial loans, small, medium business loans, growing at 12, 18 months ago, 10%. Today, it's growing at 2%. There's barely any lending to business going on by the banks. Oh, the banks are lending. Yes, yes, but, you know, they're lending offshore, and they're lending to speculators, and they're investing themselves in financial asset market. A lot of this money is flowing out to emerging markets, you know, dollar-denominated bonds by emerging market, big hot area. It's not having an effect on the U.S. economy. Yeah, I mean, bank lending is almost dead in the water. Another indicator of the weak economy, government tax revenues. If there was increased investment in hiring and spending, you would see an increase in government tax revenues. Well, they announced last week the government deficit for the month, $90 billion deficit. Well, just multiply that times 12. Over $1 trillion of deficit potentially this year, $1 trillion deficit. That was the same level of government deficit we had in 2008-09 each year. Actually, it was a little bit more than that. I mean, that's recession. When you see that kind of a deficit rising, because the deficit rising is largely the result of insufficient tax revenue. It's not because the government's spending more, although they are spending more on defense, so it's partly that. But it's the tax revenue declining. Economic activity is slowing. Tax revenues are slowing. And now we got the Congress, the Republicans, wanting to give trillion and Trump $1 trillion additional tax cuts. Additional. The forecast, official forecast, about a Congressional Budget Office is this fiscal year that ends in September, $700 billion government deficit. And that's mostly because of revenue falloff, because of the weak economy and tax cuts, you see. You could wipe out this deficit tomorrow if you just raise taxes back to where they were decades ago. It would be gone. And you could do all the infrastructure spending and job creating you wanted. Yeah, but they're not going to do that because the rich and their corporations have a stranglehold, particularly the financial, on the government. Okay, so, you know, all those are signs. Don't look at this phony U3 unemployment rate as a sign, and job creation of contingent independent contractors as a sign of a robust economy, because that's not. By the way, autos are also auto sales are a major indicator of where the economy is going, and they're going south, right? You get a good deal on the car a year from now, maybe even by Christmas, right? All of you who bought your cars this year, last year, bought them too early. Okay, so she had her meeting here, Yellen, Janet Yellen. You see, announced, oh, the economy is doing fine, you know, and oh, inflation might be slowing. Oh, but that's just temporary. Transitory is the phrase they used. This was just transitory, this low inflation. And the argument was made, transitory in the sense of temporary factors were responsible for the slowing inflation, temporary factors. Like what? Oh, mobile phone contracts. You know, competition among the telecom companies, and the cost of mobile phone contracts were huge, and therefore bringing down the price indicators. And oh, healthcare costs were slowing. Because people aren't spending on healthcare. Can't afford their huge deductibles. You know, they can just have emergency health care, not normal health care. Okay, so, you know, those transitory factors, and when she announced here a month or so ago the Fed decision to raise rates one more time, and at that same meeting, she indicated that the Fed was going to start selling off its $4.5 trillion balance sheet. Right, so two things, balance sheet sell-off and rate hikes are coming, according to the Fed last month. Oh, well, they're not going to come very fast, if at all. So a lot of talk, because the economy's too weak, and they know it. Well, now this past week, Janet had a meeting, press conference, and she said, there may be more going on here with regard to inflation than just these transitory factors. Ooh, little indicator. Maybe she's not so confident that it's transitory. A lot of people say it's not transitory, and it's not. But they're going to raise rates anyway. Well, that's what they said. You know, the official scenario is the following. You listen to talking heads on Bloomberg and so forth, and officially what they're saying is that the Fed will announce at its upcoming Jackson Hole, Wyoming annual confab. Here all the central bankers and big capitalists get together. Will announce it will start selling off its $4.5 trillion balance sheet here. Probably by the end of the year, it'll start selling off. Well, the sell-off is going to be so token, like $5 billion a month. They're going to sell off $5 billion a month? Well, gee, that over, if they do that for a whole year, that's $60 billion reduction in a $4.5 trillion balance sheet. $60 billion, that's token, that's nothing. And part of this official scenario, consensus scenario here is that the Fed will raise interest rates once again in December. All right, so announce the balance sheet sell-off in September to start probably the beginning of the year, maybe earlier, and raise rates one more time. All right. The Fed knows it cannot raise interest rates very much. It knows this. The economy is too weak. So it's going to try to sell off the balance sheet, which will raise rates indirectly, you see. Put more supply of money, you know, that reduces price, raises rates. So there'll be more of a focus on balance sheet, but it'll be very token. And I predict that you're not going to have another rate hike in December. That's what I predict. I think the economy is going to get weaker slowly between now and then. And they're not going to raise rates, and they're going to focus on talk about balance sheet sell-off. They're not also, another reason they're not going to do anything dramatic is that Yellen is gone. Janet Yellen will not be reappointed in January. It will be Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs. Yes. Goldman Sachs deepening its claws in all these economic, key economic institutions and running the show behind the scenes in the interest of Goldman Sachs. You know, they talk about Donald Trump making decisions based on benefiting his companies and so forth. Well, he's just one of many who are doing that. Goldman Sachs is doing that, of course, big time. Oh, and Yellen says, there's not going to be another financial crisis in our lifetime, unquote. the Fed has done such a good job in bank supervision. There won't be another financial crisis in our lifetime. Famous last words, right? Sounds like Neil Chamberlain, 1938. Peace in our time, right? We know what happened then. Well, another financial crisis is coming. Not in the way they think it is. And it probably will come out of China or Europe, maybe even emerging markets, but more likely China or Europe. Already, you know, there's about $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans around the world. Is that a stable financial system? $10 trillion in non-performing loans by banks? Doesn't sound too stable to me. You know, trillions, at least several trillion in both Japan and Europe, and about $5 trillion non-performing loans, $4 to $5 trillion in China. Okay. Well, why does everything seem to still keep going? We got these bubbles in stocks and bonds. We got, well, the bond thing is unwinding a little now. And, you know, we've got all these non-performing bank loans, and they're deregulating as fast as they can in the process, which will make it more unstable, unwinding all the token limited re-regulations that they imposed after 2009. So it's increasingly unstable, not stable, so going to be interesting here. There will be another financial crisis question. It's just when, not whether, but when. All right. We should say something about the European Central Bank and the Bank of England and so forth. You know, they're all following the Fed. The Fed is the central bank of central banks, and all the other capitalist big banks, capitalist central banks, key off of the Federal Reserve, either directly or indirectly. They do either the same thing or they do just the opposite, but you know, depending on their domestic goals, the Fed influences all the rest. Well, what do we got here? In the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi signaled here, in the wake of Yellen's indication of starting to sell off the balance sheet, well, Mario said the same thing. Well, we might consider selling off the balance sheet, you know, and if you're going to do that, of course, then raise rates is another question. You know, when you're going to raise rates? Well, the ECB, the U.S. Stopped its... Well, slowed its QE in 2013 and then just refilled the banks' maturing bonds ever since that under Yellen. And in 2015, the European Central Bank jumped into the QE big time, introduced its own QE program, buying $68 billion a month, of government bonds and corporate bonds. By the way, you know, they're buying mostly the bonds of those economies in Europe that are in better shape than those that aren't. You know, they're not really buying the Greek and Portugal and even Italian bonds. They're buying the German bonds and the Netherlands bonds, right? And they're running out of bonds. That's another reason why they either have to slow down their QEs or start buying, as they have in Japan, stocks and properties, real estate and so forth. That's really desperate in Japan, you see. In Japan, you know, the central bank, Bank of Japan, is propping up the whole system, all the financial markets, you know, not just the bond markets, but, you know, the stock markets, everything is being propped up by the Bank of Japan. You'd have a massive depression there if it pulled out, a financial crash. If it pulled out of doing that. But back to the ECB, the European Central Bank, it signaled, Mario Draghi, the chair, has signaled that he's going to probably follow the Fed. And, making a lot of people nervous there because, see, when you drive down interest rates so low for 8 years, for so long, and even in Europe, some of the bond rates went negative, you got a lot of investors who bought those bonds, and now you're going to start raising those rates, and whoever bought those bonds are going to take big losses. And as soon as they see that it's clear that their losses are going to start, they're going to dump those bonds, you see. Crisis. The Fed and the central banks have put themselves in the corner by continuing zero rates, negative rates even, for so long. They've conditioned the system, and they can't raise rates without precipitating a crisis, you see. They lowered rates in response to a crisis, kept them too low too long, because they're subsidizing the system now, because the politicians, the banks become political controllers, and they insist on free money continuing for 8 years. But they put themselves in a corner because now they can't raise rates very much without precipitating a crisis. So the solution to the crisis in 2008-09 is now the cause of the next one. The grand contradiction, as I call it in my book, central bankers at the end of their ropes. Yes, the decades of central bank providing low-cost money, which began in the late 70s, continued pumping all this liquidity, money, into their economies and the global economy for decades, started causing financial bubbles, which have grown and spread geographically, grown across markets and deepened, erupted in 2008 and the worst to date. And we got bubbles going ever since then. This whole process that created all this excess liquidity that fed all these financial markets and the bubbles, they are the central cause. The central banks are one of the main causes, and with the bankers running the central banks indirectly, and I talk about that in the book, how they run the banks indirectly, you know, at the district levels and at the governor levels and so forth. I don't want to get into that right now. It's too technical. But they created this monster, this massive liquidity monster, pumping all this money for decades, and, you know, dollars and euros since 1999, and pounds and yen and everything, pumping all this money, tens of trillions of dollars into the system, feeding all this financial speculation and all these bubbles, created this crisis because the financial bubbles then burst and dragged down the rest of the economy as they did in 2008-09. So all this excess liquidity is the cause of these, of the debt. You see it with debt and leveraging. All the excess liquidity becomes easy credit, more debt. Debt is just a symptom. You see, you got people writing books about debt is the problem. No, debt is the symptom of the problem. The problem is all this free money, low-cost free money for so long. And it's there because the banks have insisted on it, made monetary policy, central bank policy primary, took over the government, you see, created the crisis. And the great contradiction is that the solution to the crisis was the cause, the same thing as what caused the crisis, all this massive injection of liquidity, free money. They caused it, and they rescued the banks with the same cause, you see, and that same cause is now the basis for the next crisis. They can't get interest rates up. I predict that the federal funds rate can't go more than 2%. It's at 1.25%, right? And the 10-year Treasury bond benchmark rate probably can't go much above 3% without precipitating a crisis. And they're very nervous. And in Europe, It's probably even more sensitive because they allowed rates to go negative over there, you see. And in Japan, they went negative. So any attempt to raise those rates even less than in the U.S. will probably precipitate another crisis over there. They're trapped. That's why another financial crisis is inevitable, Janet. Not in our lifetimes. Well, I don't know, Janet. Are you preparing to depart pretty soon? They're subsidizing the banking system. The central banks, now controlled by the private bankers, increasingly over the last several decades. You see it with Goldman Sachs running the government. You know, they talk about central bank independence from the government. Well, but who runs the government? Right? Is it independence from the U.S. Treasury, or is it independence from Goldman Sachs running the Treasury, and before them, Citigroup running the Treasury? Independence from whom? Who are you talking about? It's not as if the government was some independent third party. The government today, more than ever before, is run by the big capitalists. They're so desperate, they even allow a guy like Trump, one of their own, into the halls of government directly. See, they like to run this thing indirectly. And the reason they don't like the Koch brothers and others, Mercers don't run themselves, is exactly what you're seeing with Trump. They got too many skeletons, economic skeletons, in their closets. And they will come to light if they take over direct role in government. That's why they always put someone else up front, as long as they can control them. Well, in the U.S., they've gotten desperate for some reason. I don't know what's going on here, except that they're running directly themselves now. And they're shining a light on themselves. In the long run, that can't be good for them. Because people start making the connection, well, you know, maybe these super rich people, you know, are really running the show. What's their game? How are they doing it? Revolving doors is one way, of course. Okay. So we've got the ECB raising rates. The Bank of England is going to raise rates soon as well. And they can't talk of selling off their balance sheet because they just reinstituted QE last year again. So you can't talk about selling it off while you're growing it. But they can raise rates, and they will. And that economy in Britain is a shambles. And that's because of Brexit, you see. The longer Brexit goes on, not resolved, the worse the economy is going to get in Britain. Britain, 5 years from now, will be an economy similar to its role in the global, you know, the global economy, a role similar to Northern Italy, something like that, or maybe a large Netherlands, right? The British influence is gone forever. Economic influence is gone forever because at least half of its financial dominance, its financial markets and systems are going to leave London for Frankfurt. That's part of Brexit, you see. Okay, so Bank of England's going to raise rates. ECB has raised rates or reduced balance sheet or whatever, right? And in Europe, they're nervously, investors are sitting nervously. You know, what is Mario Draghi, the chair, going to say when he goes to this Jackson Hole meeting of central bankers globally in Wyoming, which occurs every year, at the end of August? What's he going to say? Is he going to announce that Europe's going to start selling off its balance sheet or raising rates? Is he going to announce that? You know, last time he went, Mario went to Jackson Hole, was in 2014, where he announced the coming of QE in Europe. So is he going to announce? Yeah, he's going to make an announcement. He's not going to Jackson Hole for nothing. And boy, does that have the investors nervous in Europe. What are we going to do holding all these bonds at zero or less low interest rates when these rates start rising? Oh, my God, we're going to lose all this money. I think we better dump these bonds. Well, you dump bonds, you got financial asset price collapse. Yeah, watch it. Watch Europe. Very unstable, right? And Britain, UK. Right? Who's going to raise rates first or next among the major central banks, right? Who's going to sell off, start selling off, announce and sell off their balance sheets, and how much? You know? And why are they doing this when inflation is not rising but falling, right? Those are the questions of the day. It's an indication that this whole monetary policy, central bank-driven regime since 2008 and 2009 is in increasing trouble. Increasing trouble. They've painted themselves into a corner. Well, they bought themselves, you know, 8-9 years, and boy, they sure enriched their investors big time. Stock market in the U.S. has tripled, S&P 500 and so forth. They've tripled. Whoa, that's a lot of money. Right? The bond markets, low interest rates have allowed corporations to issue close to $6 trillion in corporate bonds because the rates are so low. $6 trillion in corporate bonds, $5 to $6 trillion. And you know what? $5 to $6 trillion is about the same amount that these corporations that have issued $5, $6 trillion in bonds, about the same amount that these same corporations have distributed to their shareholders over the same period since 2008 in the form of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. It's almost one for one. And that's just the bonds. I'm not talking about the financial assets, the money they've made from stock price appreciation, or the money they made from derivatives. Who knows? No one knows, because that's all opaque, you know, or manipulating, speculating in currencies or real estate. It's been massive. They've really enriched themselves immeasurably in the last 10 years, 8-9 years, because of this whole monetary policy first. And that's why you got such massive accelerating income inequality. You know, income inequality, you know, it's a percentage thing, and you can get more inequality if wages don't grow or decline, which has happened, but you can get more inequality if capital incomes accelerate, and boom, which has more than happened. Both forces, holding down wages and income, wage earned income, and escalating capital incomes, is why you've got this huge income inequality gap in the U.S. and the advanced economies going on. In other words, the income inequality has a lot to do with central bank policies. But you won't hear Paul Krugman talking about that, and the liberals, who think they're Keynesians, but they're not. They're hybrid Keynesians. You know, they're more pre-Keynesian than they are Keynesians. Well, my other book talked about that, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, last year. Took a big swipe at mainstream economics. About a third of the book. Anyway, what we've got going on today is some big issues in monetary policy, which has been in the driver's seat for quite some time as the only policy regime. And that's why fiscal policy and austerity is a reflection of that. You see, if you put all your eggs in the monetary policy basket, central bank basket, then you're going to de-emphasize fiscal policy. You don't want fiscal policy running counter to your monetary policy. Well, how would it do that? Well, the monetary policy, central bank policy, is all about, as I said, giving free money to the bankers, which then disseminate to these financial asset markets and other non-bank companies, In other words, they get upfront subsidized, immediate, rich, directly, quickly. Monetary policy restores capital incomes directly and rapidly. And the hope is, well, you know, maybe they'll have so much money, they'll trick a little bit down into real investment, creating real jobs and so forth. Well, they haven't done much of that. Conversely, if you had fiscal policy, you would be pumping money into households through government spending. And households would pick up and buy stuff, increasing demand for products and sales and revenues, and corporations then would get recovery indirectly, delayed, lagged indirectly. That's what fiscal policy is. Well, you know, if you're running the government and economic policy, you would rather do the former, wouldn't you? Let's enrich ourselves real quick, and maybe we'll dribble some down instead of, well, let's, you know, recover from the bottom up, make sure these households got money to buy our stuff. They don't want to do that. And they certainly don't want to do the former, the monetary policy, and do the latter, the fiscal policy, because the fiscal policy kind of contradicts the monetary policy, as I've just described it. That's why austerity is the flip side of monetary policy, fiscal policy, fiscal austerity. Now, in Europe, where the crisis is even more intense, and Japan even more intense than that, right? You see fiscal policy that's really severe austerity. In the U.S., it's been moderate austerity. You know, originally, Obama put in $800 billion for fiscal stimulus, although $300 billion that was tax cuts. But in 2011, they took it all back and then some, you know, with the fiscal cliff. Remember that? August 2011. $1 trillion cutting and spending? Yeah. So the U.S. wasn't as severe as Europe and Japan, but it was the same thing. It was austerity. But austerity, you've got to understand, is a secondary consequence of this monetary policy regime, central bank regime, driving the show. And that's where we are. And the next shoe is going to drop at Jackson Hole, Wyoming in August. We'll see what happens then. We'll see what happens in terms of the Fed and its policies. Will it slow its balance sheet sell-off plans, slow its interest rate hike plans as the U.S. economy gets weaker? Or will it continue? And at what point will the rising rates from both those decisions hit the wall, and we have a precipitated, even faster slowdown, and maybe even financial asset contraction, price contractions. Okay, we'll see what happens. But that's the grand strategy unrolling here, and the grand contradiction. All right, next week, I'm sure there'll be a lot of interesting news, and we'll talk more about my constitutional amendment to change this whole picture in terms of central bank and monetary policy in the U.S.